I, you know, just because you don't completely agree with something you don't understand, you know, there's no reason why, you know, you should be a communist and write with your left hand. And it's really wild. Through Vietnam, these things just kept going on and going on and going on. I could relate to you that went on. I mean, like, you've gone through this, right? You've gone through the whole thing. But even the people that were on our side, man, even the people that were fighting with us were still lower class, second class citizens, you know? Since there weren't that many, they were a complete different race. We would call them niggers, you know, in this country. Over there, we call them gooks. You know, it's the same thing. They're second-class citizens. It's a complete racism thing, you know. Okay, so what happens? Like, even the people that are supposed to be on our side, they're supposed to be fighting with us, right? I have an example here. This isn't an atrocity, you know. It isn't blood and gore. We went into a village, and we searched the people, and not everyone, understandably, could be in the military because someone had to, you know, work the land. Someone had to provide the food. Okay, who was going to do this? It was people that, you know, had special permits, special passes, special ID cards. Now, these are the people that are on our side. We went into a village, and we took the ID cards off of people and sent them back to the rear. I have one here that the press can verify after. Bill Schmidt, the Detroit Free Press, is supposed to be running this down. I don't know how far he's got with it. I'd like to know what happened to this man. Not this man, but all of our yellow brothers. It's just a big racism thing. You know, they're all complete second-class citizens. And it's really hideous, you know. There's a number of things. And then when I come out of the service, and I come back, and I would go into the bars where my friends used to loaf, and you know I would hear these same things going on that went on before I left. But now things had changed for me, see, because like I had seen what was going on. I had firsthand, you know, I had witnessed these things, and I wasn't getting it from the Pittsburgh Press or the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette or anything like that, man. I had seen it, and I had, my father, my parents had sent me clippings of these massive massassacres that we had committed, the 198th, which weren't true. You know, they simply weren't true. And it's the same thing that's been brought up all day long about the body counts. Everything is a bunch of lies, and you get people sitting back here, you know, back here, and they believe this stuff, and that's what we've got to get out. I really believe it. And I don't, like I've said before, you know, I think this is being a true American. I think it's, you know, sticking up for your country. Damn it, I love this country, and I can't see it being run by fascist pigs, you know?
I came here for a lot of reasons that were just mentioned by the previous people talking. I have bad dreams, I have nightmares, I have guilt feelings. I would like to see true self-determination by the Vietnamese people. But most of all, I think primary and utmost, I'd like to see the war ended. Because I think that's the first thing we can do in order to get our country together.
Pardon me. We have to cut this short. So we're just going to have to make one statement. We all belong to the unit that Lieutenant Calley belonged to. And what's been brought out during this whole testimony is that it's a general policy and not an isolated incident. We're trained from basic training, AIT and OCS, to kill, and that's what we're out there to do. It is not the fault of Lieutenant Calley. It is not the fault of the infantrymen in his platoon, but the fault of the U.S. government and the U.S. military establishment. The whole system is nothing, is set up to dehumanize us and to make everybody we see a non-human so that we can kill them. It would be impossible with our background to go into a village and kill a woman and child unless we looked at those people as non-humans. And because of the service and because of the military establishment, that's how we look at the Vietnamese. If there are any questions, ask now, but we have a very short amount of time. A very short amount. Go ahead, ma'am.
Nobody really likes war. I don't like it either. But if you go into a war, it's kill or be killed. Now, if you see a Vietnamese person there with a hand grenade sitting in the rice paddy, you better kill him or they'll kill you.
That's You've never seen that, lady.
Ma'am, we're not talking about a Viet Cong with a weapon. We're talking about a civilian, a person with a hoe in his hand. We're talking about a woman and child in a bunker. We're talking about May Lai, which happens every day. Every day, ma'am, and it happens in the United States, too. Pardon me, ma'am, pardon me. Pardon me, we don't have time for that. I'm sorry, we have to cut it short now.
Excuse me, we have one announcement, please. The veterans that are going to Washington, anyone who wishes to go to Washington and speak to the Senate subcommittee, would you please meet in the vets room? And anyone who could give us rides to Washington, would you please go by the back door back here and sign up and get all the information you need?
Windsor, too. Anybody going to Windsor?
Also for the Windsor thing tonight to meet with the Vietnamese. Oh, yes, we're having cars towed away from the no parking zones out here, so could you kindly remove your cars?
Pickle panel. And we'll be playing that segment of the Winter Soldier investigation in about 15 minutes. WBAI, listener-sponsored, non-commercial radio in New York City at 99.5 FM. We continue now with the Winter Soldier investigation. Coming up next is the medical panel.
Formerly a major in the U.S. Army Medical Corps, I have my DD-214 right here, which is an honorable discharge form. I was a psychiatry neurology consultant in Vietnam. Between 1964 and 1965, I also functioned for 5 months as a flight surgeon in the Mekong Delta. I was deputy surgeon of the United States Support Command at the time. When I returned from Vietnam, I must admit that I wasn't happy with our policy there before I went there, even in 1964, just after the overthrow of Diem. When I came back, I was extremely disgusted and I resigned my commission. I'd like each of the panel members to introduce themselves. They would. Why don't we start with you, Mark?
Which end are we starting?
Go ahead.
Not on.
Does it work?
Is this one on?
Yeah.
My name is Michael Erard. I served as a medic with the 173rd, 3rd of the 503rd.
My name is Joseph Grasso. I was a general medical officer for the 173rd Airborne Brigade in Vietnam.
My name is David Galacia. I served as psychiatrist, 3rd Field Hospital, Saigon, Republic of Vietnam.
My name is Jeff Dubrell. I was a hospital corpsman on the USS Sanctuary in Da Nang.
My name is Dave Fort, and I serve as the driver for 3rd Medical Battalion, 3rd Marine Division in Quang Tri.
My name is Gary Steiger, and I served as the medic in the 366th USOF Dispensary at Da Nang.
Okay, thank you. The first thing we will try to demonstrate is there was a variance of treatment which was not medically sound in terms of preference for patients. That is, Americans got the best treatment if an Arvin had the same type of problem, wound, what have you. He got the second best. Prisoners got the worst by far. And we're going to take it by subjects. Mike, why don't you start off with something about how prisoners were treated by our medical people.
We had a policy whereby prisoners were given just the basic treatment. In other words, they were maybe a bandage or a field dressing was put on a wound. We were instructed, and this was battalion SOP, that we were to expend no medical supplies on them. In other words, specifically, we had we carried a small bottle of serum albumin, 500 cc's, to be used for people who were in shock or had serious wounds. When we went out in the field, we were told this costs $25. It's never to be used on a gook, meaning both Vietnamese and prisoners.
Anybody else want to comment on it? Dave, what about you? What have you seen happen with prisoners?
Basically, just working. Yeah, I think it's going now. Basically, in regard to a lot of various incidences, but I can relate one specifically to you, where a prisoner would be brought in to triage, which is immediately where they're operated on, or not operated on, but they get their basic medical treatment in there before they go on to their specific needs, like operations and things which had to be performed directly by a doctor. Well, they're in triage. A prisoner would then, he'd be interrogated. They'd come down with ITT, which is intelligence and translations people, and they try and get information from the prisoners. And while they're doing it, if the prisoner wouldn't give information out by the questions they ask, they'd use various ways of torture. They'd probably, they'd poke at his wounds. I've seen him stand a prisoner up who had a stomach wound. His shoulder was torn up. They generally harass the prisoner until they can get any information out of him. In this particular instance, they couldn't get anything out of him. I don't even think he could speak. He was in pretty bad shape. They took him to an operating room, and in the operating room, he wasn't treated by a doctor such as Americans were, and it wasn't, I don't know, sterile conditions, even if they exist, it was less than normal in this case. What they did is, like, rather than having a doctor which would work on an American, they'd have corpsmen, which would more, I guess you could say he was, they were practicing or getting experience from working on the prisoners that came in. He was in pretty bad shape. They had a little, very little regard whatsoever for the concern of him once they got him out of the operating room. All they were doing is like, okay, we got to do it, so we're going to do it, you know, but like, who cares whether he lives or dies? It's just something that has to be done. There was one doctor present. Other than that, the corpsman did all the major work. They set bones very sloppily, and I know if you can set a bone, probably a lot of people know this, that if you set it sloppily, it's going to come out crooked. They don't care. Like you've heard all this time through testimony, you're dehumanized, and yellow people in your eyes are just completely dehumanized. They're not even human. You have no regard for them, so you don't care what happens to them, and a prisoner is more so than anyone else. Instances like this go on all the time. This is just one I could bring up. I don't know what happened to him once he left that operating room.
Maybe you said that there was an American doctor present when they tortured this guy? Or
When the interrogation people came in, he was still in triage. He was laying on a stretcher. He was in really bad shape. ITT is intelligence. It's translations. It's getting information from prisoners and working a little bit with civilians. But they came in. There's a doctor present. The doctor's not concerned with intelligence. But ITT has a, they had a captain in this case, which is a Marine officer, and two Arvin, South Vietnamese intelligence people, one which was an officer, one which was a staff officer, or staff sergeant. And they're the ones who interrogated him. The officer was present. He ignored the interrogation. As a matter of fact, he almost went along with it. He didn't actually touch the prisoner, but he didn't say anything to stop the torture, the whatever you want to call it, that was going on.
Okay, what about treatment of Arvin or civilians? I think, Jeff, you had seen some things that...
I worked in the surgical unit on board the Sanctuary, and most of the minor surgical procedures that were done on the Sanctuary were done in the recovery room, such as debridement of wounds or minor suturing cases, things like that. And an Arvin soldier came in one day, and this one doctor, who I've seen do this about 10 times, I set him up for his procedure. It was a debridement of a wound. And it's done under a local anesthesia, like Xylocaine or Novocaine. And I set the tray out, and I drew up 10 cc's of Xylocaine. And the Arvin was pretty apprehensive about what was going to be happening to him, so we had the interpreter tell him what was going on. And he calmed down, and about 5-10 minutes later, he was screaming like crazy. You know, I ran over to see what was the matter, and I noticed that the syringe hadn't been touched, and the doctor was performing this procedure without anesthesia. And he has done this about 10 times. I've seen him do it. And he was a lieutenant commander, by the way, which is like a major, so he knew better. Also, the same doctor claimed, like in some case, he was rushed, like from one case to another, like in suturing cases, and I've seen him perform suturing cases without the use of sterile technique. In other words, no gloves, and it only takes 15 seconds to put a glove on, you know, so there was no excuse for that. This was, like I said, done only on Arvin soldiers, not Americans. Another doctor, who's a lieutenant commander also, performed 27 out of 30 negative laparotomy cases. A laparotomy is cutting into the abdomen and exposing the intestines and repairing any tear or wound that would be, you know, in the intestines. And the x-rays would come in with the patient from triage or from x-ray or wherever. And I'd put the x-rays up on the screen, so I saw every x-ray that came in on these patients. And you could see a metal fragment in the intestine. It stands out like a sore thumb. It's just like a big, you know, lump in the middle of, you know, like nothing. You can really see it. And if, let's say, an Arvin or a Vietnamese civilian would come in with like a fragment wound of the, you know, arm or leg or something like that, he would automatically order a laparotomy, you know, to be set up on him. You know, and we can't question him because I'm only an E4 and he was a lieutenant commander, so I had to do what I was told. So he would do these cases that didn't have to be done, and a laparotomy can be, you know, an easy case if it's like, if there's a frag there, you could take the frag out, repair the, you know, the wound, and that's it. If sometimes it can be a very, you know, bad case, it could be a lot of bleeding done. I've seen fellows, you know, from a simple frag wound of the stomach, you know, die in surgery. And he would do these cases, you know, and they wouldn't have to be done. And like I said, it was 27 out of 30 negative cases. That's about all I have to say.
In an American hospital, we would be kicked off any staff. Sounds like, Jeff, you're pretty knowledgeable about medicine. How much training did you have to be a medic?
I went to basic hospital core school. And orthopedic technician school in Philadelphia, and OJT OR technician in Vietnam.
And what are you doing now?
Nothing.
Why?
Civilian hospitals, somehow, they just think that Navy corpsmen or any Army medics or whatever, the only thing they're good for would be making beds and passing out bedpans. They think the training we have is insufficient, and they won't give any ex-medics a chance to prove themselves. So needless to say, medics, you know, won't work in a lot of civilian hospitals because after what they've done in Vietnam or in the service, even if they haven't gone over there, Like, they don't want to push bedpans around all day. They want to get into, you know, down to the nitty-gritty and really get into some work. But they can't do this.
You can probably do most things a nurse can do, right?
Most things nurses can do, I can do probably more than a nurse can do. Nurses cannot suture. I've sutured. I've debrided wounds where nurses can't. So.
Okay. What about in the triage? Gary, want to explain what triage is and how it worked in terms of Vietnamese versus Americans?
Well, sometimes when we had days off, we worked 6 days a week in Vietnam in our dispensary, and you could get pretty bored on your days off because there wasn't really a heck of a lot to do. And there were, I think, six hospitals in the area, including the ship that Jeff was on. And oftentimes the Air Force medics would go to the Navy or Marine hospitals, and I worked quite a bit in those places. And triage is a system whereby the patients are divided into three main categories for treatment. If you have a person coming in who has is really badly wounded, he may have a limb or two missing or multiple shrapnel wounds or whatever, he is usually placed in a category, and they expect him to die. He's placed in a category expectant. Right after those people come the guys that, if they weren't treated immediately, would possibly die. The people in the expectant category, chances are they wouldn't make it even with surgery. And the third category is the delay, in which your guys come in, maybe have minor wounds or things like this. When patients came in, not only to the Navy hospitals and others, but when they came into our casualty staging flight where I worked, these patients would usually be the ones that were treated last. You could have an American come in an expectant category who there was no way that he was going to make it. And the doctors would oftentimes treat him before they would treat an Arvin soldier or a NLF soldier or whatever in a lower category who had a really good chance of making it if he was taken care of. Most of the time, the corpsman would give him basic first aid, and that was it. Like, you know, you weren't supposed to use any more of your supplies on them than was absolutely necessary to get them out of your facility or to a Vietnamese hospital. Now, the prisoners that I saw that we handled, they were taken into our hospitals, they didn't receive treatment. I mean, it's no way to, like, I lose the words. I mean, they were lower than worms as far as these people were concerned. I mean, you don't treat worms and you don't treat Arvin. It was about the same thing. When they came and we bring them in on a medevac, the Air Force flies cargo planes. They're hooked up for carrying litters, and they carry wounded personnel and so forth on them. These planes would come in, and you'd have a C-130, which could maybe carry 60 American wounded, would come in with over 100 Vietnamese on it, well over 100, stacked on top of each other and everything else. These people would get off, they'd be taken off the plane, you'd have a man, say, in a body cast, you know, cast from his neck to his knees, and he'd be walking down the ramp and somebody would trip. This guy'd fall 3 feet. He's maybe has half the bones in his body broken, and the doctor had spent hours in an OR working on him, and they'd drop him from 3 feet. We put him into buses, and they were tossed into the buses more than put. We take him down to the Arvin hospitals. Instead of taking him to a place where they could be treated, they'd be taken there. And even if the Arvin didn't have the facilities, which they don't have, to treat these patients, we'd leave them anyway. The prisoners were transferred, oftentimes there's, I think, several hospitals that take care of these. One was where John was at, it is at Long Tao, and there's one at Chu Lai. And it was common knowledge amongst the people that were working on the flight line transferring these prisoners. They were turned over to the Koreans. And it was a standing joke that at the Korean hospital, that if you had a patient who was really bad off, and you were sending someone down there who wasn't quite so bad off and they didn't have the beds, that the one in the bed that was going to die anyway would either be shot or something else done to him so they'd have room. And this happened all the time. The patients that we got in our casualty staging flight would sit up in the end of the ward, and if you were lucky, you could give them some water. It wasn't worth your time to treat them. And that's the way I saw it. And unless we can realize that those people are human beings and they were killing human beings over there, and that they are the same flesh and blood that which we are, I don't know. We're just not human beings ourselves.
Okay, I'm going to throw this kind of open to you, because I'm sure you've all had experience with it. There's a program in Vietnam that started, probably was the first major attempt at, quote, pacification, called the Medical Civil Action Project. This was begun about 6 months before I got there under Mac V, and then later all the medical units were to some extent rewarded, reinforced, encouraged to become involved in medical civil action, which the press liked to build up. So it's open for grabs. Maybe Joe, why don't you start off on medical MedCap? What's it all about?
Is this working?
Yes.
Well, in general, it was an attempt to use the practice of medicine as a propaganda device. Essentially, it consisted of bringing into a village personnel and equipment and give the impression that some kind of a treatment facility was being provided for the people. That itself was well-meaning, but the program involved the sporadic and often the inadvertent distribution of antibiotic of all kinds, both oral antibiotics and injectable antibiotics, which in itself is a very dangerous procedure, and one which can ultimately disturb the normal bacterial flora which these people have carried for so many thousands of years. Now, while I was in Vietnam, of course, the Surgeon General's office issued a proclamation stating that no tuberculosis disease would be treated. However, it was obvious that at the time that the Medical Civic Action Program personnel had been attempting to treat tuberculosis in the villages with inadequate doses of antibiotic, and this certainly is a practice which is detrimental both to the people who have tuberculosis and to the other people in the village. Most of the other practices that were common in the MedCap program, I believe to be contrary to what I had been taught in medical school. I believe most of us, even the lay public, is aware that to treat someone inadequately with antibiotics is a dangerous process. However, this is something that went on all the time in the villages. And it wasn't the fault of any of the medics who distributed the antibiotics, because they certainly couldn't be responsible for a command policy which allowed a jeep with medical supplies to go into a village. Oftentimes, the jeep would go into the village and the villagers themselves would procure the medicine from the jeep, would just take the medication right from the jeep. The medical personnel there not being able to control 200 or 300 villagers picking at a medical chest filled with outdated surplus medicinals. And I should add that more than more often than not, the medications that we used in the medical program were out of date, were surplus, were things that we had no use for in our own medical operations for the military.